Don Juan seldom spoke openly about Mescalito. Every time I questioned him on the subject, he refused to talk, but he always said enough to create an impression of Mescalito, an impression that was always anthropomorphic. Mescalito was a male, not only because of the mandatory grammatical rule that gives the word a masculine gender, but also because of his constant qualities of being a protector and a teacher. Don Juan reaffirmed these characteristics in various forms every time we talked. Friday, July 6, 1962. Don Juan and I started on a trip late in the afternoon of Saturday, June 23rd. He said we were going to look for honguitos, mushrooms, in the state of Chihuahua. He said it was going to be a long, hard trip. He was right. We arrived in a little mining town in northern Chihuahua at 10 p.m. on Wednesday, June 27th. We walked from the place I had parked the car at the outskirts of town to the house of his friends, a Tarahumara Indian and his wife. We slept there. The next morning the man woke us up around 5. He brought us gruel and beans. He sat and talked to Don Juan while we ate, but he said nothing concerning our trip. After breakfast the man put water into my canteen and 2 sweet rolls into my knapsack. Don Juan handed me the canteen, fixed the knapsack with a cord over his shoulders, thanked the man for his courtesies, and turning to me said, "It's time to go." We walked on the dirt road for about a mile. From there we cut through the fields, and in 2 hours we were at the foot of the hill south of town. We climbed the gentle slopes in a southwesterly direction. When we reached the steeper inclines, Don Juan changed directions, and we followed a high valley to the east. Despite his advanced age, Don Juan kept up a pace so incredibly fast that by midday I was completely exhausted. We sat down and he opened the bread sack. "You can eat all of it if you want," he said. "How about you?" "I'm not hungry, and we won't need this food later on." I was very tired and hungry and took him up on his offer. I felt this was a good time to talk about the purpose of our trip, and quite casually I asked, "Do you think we're going to stay here for a long time?" "We are here to gather some mescalito. We will stay until tomorrow." "Where is mescalito?" "All around us." Cacti of many species were growing in profusion all through the area, but I could not distinguish peyote among them. We started to hike again, and by 3 o'clock we came to a long, narrow valley with steep side hills. I felt strangely excited at the idea of finding peyote, which I had never seen in its natural environment. We entered the valley and must have walked about 400 feet when suddenly I spotted 3 unmistakable peyote plants. They were in a cluster a few inches above the ground in front of me, to the left of the path. They looked like round, pulpy green roses. I ran toward them, pointing them out to Don Juan. He ignored me and deliberately kept his back turned as he walked away. I knew I had done the wrong thing. And for the rest of the afternoon we walked in silence, moving slowly on the flat valley floor, which was covered with small, sharp-edged rocks. We moved among the cacti, disturbing crowds of lizards and at times a solitary bird, and I passed scores of peyote plants without saying a word. At 6 o'clock we were at the bottom of the mountains that marked the end of the valley. We climbed to a ledge. Don Juan dropped his sack and sat down. I was hungry again, but we had no food left. I suggested that we pick up the mescalito and head back for town. He looked annoyed and made a smacking sound with his lips. He said we were going to spend the night there. We sat quietly. There was a rock wall to the left, and to the right was the valley we had just crossed. It extended for quite a distance and seemed to be wider then and not so flat as I had thought. Viewed from the spot where I sat, it was full of small hills and protuberances. "Tomorrow we will start walking back," Don Juan said without looking at me and pointing to the valley. "We will work our way back and pick him as we cross the field. That is, we will pick him only when he is in our way. He will find us and not the other way around. He will find us if he wants to." Don Juan rested his back against the rock wall and with his head turned to his side continued talking as though another person were there besides myself. "One more thing. Only I can pick him. You will perhaps carry the bag or walk ahead of me, I don't know yet. But tomorrow you will not point at him as you did today." "I'm sorry, Don Juan." "It's all right, you didn't know." Don Juan sat motionless facing the peyote field. A steady wind blew on my face. "The twilight is the crack between the worlds," he said softly, without turning to me. I didn't ask what he meant. My eyes became tired. Suddenly I felt elated. I had a strange, overpowering desire to weep. I lay on my stomach. The rock floor was hard and uncomfortable, and I had to change my position every few minutes. Finally, I sat up and crossed my legs. To my amazement, this position was supremely comfortable, and I fell asleep. When I woke up, I heard Don Juan talking to me. It was very dark. I could not see him well. I did not understand what he said, but I followed him when he started to go down from the ledge. We moved carefully, or at least I did, because of the darkness. We stopped at the bottom of the rock wall. Don Juan sat down and signaled me to sit at his left. He opened up his shirt and took out a leather sack, which he opened and placed on the ground in front of him. It contained a number of dried peyote buttons. After a long pause, he picked up one of the buttons. He held it in his right hand, rubbing it several times between the thumb and the first finger as he chanted softly. Suddenly, he let out a tremendous cry.
Ahi!
It was weird. Unexpected. It terrified me. Vaguely, I saw him place the peyote button in his mouth and begin to chew it. After a moment, he picked up the whole sack, leaned toward me and told me in a whisper to take the sack, pick out one mescalito, put the sack in front of us again, and then do exactly as he did. I picked a peyote button and rubbed it as he had done. Meanwhile, he chanted, swaying back and forth. I tried to put the button into my mouth several times, but I felt embarrassed to cry out. Then, as if in a dream, an unbelievable shriek came out of me.
Ahi!
For a moment, I thought it was someone else. Again, I felt the effects of a nervous shock in my stomach. Don Juan picked up another button and handed me the sack, and the cycle was renewed and repeated until I had chewed 14 buttons. By this time, all my early sensations of thirst, cold, and discomfort had disappeared. In their place, I felt an unfamiliar sense of warmth and excitation. I took the canteen to freshen my mouth, but it was empty. "Can we go to the creek, Don Juan?" I repeated the question. My voice sounded as though I was talking inside a vault. Don Juan did not answer. I got up and turned in the direction of the creek. I looked at him to see if he was coming, but he seemed to be listening attentively to something. He made an imperative sign with his hand to be quiet.
"Abutol is already here," he said.
I had never heard that word before, and I was wondering whether to ask him about it when I detected a noise that seemed to be a buzzing inside my ears. The sound became louder by degrees until it was like the vibration caused by an enormous bull roarer. It lasted for a brief moment and subsided gradually until everything was quiet again. The violence and the intensity of the noise terrified me. I was shaking so much that I could hardly remain standing, yet I was perfectly rational. If I had been drowsy a few minutes before, this feeling had totally vanished, giving way to a state of extreme lucidity. The noise reminded me of a science fiction movie in which a gigantic bee buzzed its wings coming out of an atomic radiation area. I laughed at the thought. I saw Don Juan slumping back into his relaxed position, and suddenly the image of a gigantic bee accosted me again. It was more real than ordinary thoughts. It stood alone, surrounded by an extraordinary clarity. Everything else was driven from my mind. This state of mental clearness, which had no precedence in my life, produced another moment of terror. I began to perspire. I leaned toward Don Juan to tell him I was afraid. His face was a few inches from mine. He was looking at me, but his eyes were the eyes of a bee. They looked like round glasses that had a light of their own in the darkness. His lips were pushed out, and from them came a pattering noise. I jumped backward, nearly crashing into the rock wall. For a seemingly endless time, I experienced an unbearable fear. I was panting and whining. The perspiration had frozen on my skin, giving me an awkward rigidity. Then I heard Don Juan's voice saying, "Get up. Move around. Get up." The image vanished, and again I could see his familiar face. "I'll get some water," I said after another endless moment. My voice cracked. I could hardly articulate the words. Don Juan nodded yes. As I walked away, I realized that my fear had gone as fast and as mysteriously as it had come. Upon approaching the creek, I noticed that I could see every object in the way. I remembered I had just seen Don Juan clearly, whereas earlier I could hardly distinguish the outlines of his figure. I stopped and looked into the distance, and I could even see across the valley. Some boulders on the other side became perfectly visible. I thought it must be early morning, but it occurred to me that I might have lost track of time. I looked at my watch. It was 10 of 12. I checked the watch to see if it was working. It couldn't be midday. It had to be midnight. I intended to make a dash for the water and come back to the rocks, but I saw Don Juan coming down, and I waited for him. I told him I could see in the dark. He stared at me for a long time without saying a word. If he did speak, perhaps I did not hear him, for I was concentrating on my new, unique ability to see in the dark. I could distinguish the very minute pebbles in the sand. At moments, everything was so clear, it seemed to be early morning or dusk. Then it would get dark. Then it would clear again. Soon I realized that the brightness corresponded to my heart's diastole and the darkness to its systole. The world changed from bright to dark to bright again with every beat of my heart. I was absorbed in this discovery when the same strange sound that I had heard before became audible again. My muscles stiffened. Anuktal, as I heard the word this time, is here, Don Juan said. I fancied the roar so thunderous, so overwhelming, that nothing else mattered. When it had subsided, I perceived a sudden increase in the volume of water. The creek, which a minute before had been less than a foot wide, expanded until it was an enormous lake. Light that seemed to come from above it touched the surface as though shining through thick foliage. From time to time the water would glitter for a second, gold and black. Then it would remain dark, lightless, almost out of sight, and yet strangely present. I don't recall how long I stayed there just watching, squatting on the shore of the black lake. The roar must have subsided in the meanwhile, because what jolted me back to reality was again a terrifying buzzing. I turned around to look for Don Juan. I saw him climbing up and disappearing behind the rock ledge. Yet the feeling of being alone did not bother me at all. I squatted there in a state of absolute confidence and abandonment. The roar again became audible. It was very intense, like the noise made by a high wind. Listening to it as carefully as I could, I was able to detect a definite melody. It was a composite of high-pitched sounds, like human voices accompanied by a deep bass drum. I focused all my attention on the melody and again noticed that the systole and diastole of my heart coincided with the sound of the bass drum and with the pattern of the music. I stood up and the melody stopped. I tried to listen to my heartbeat, but it was not detectable. I squatted again, thinking that perhaps the position of my body had caused or induced the sounds. But nothing happened. Not a sound. Not even my heart. I thought I had had enough, but as I stood up to leave, I felt a tremor of the earth. The ground under my feet was shaking. I was losing my balance. I fell backwards and remained on my back while the earth shook violently. I tried to grab a rock or a plant, but something was sliding under me. I jumped up, stood for a moment, and fell down again. The ground on which I sat was moving, sliding into the water like a raft. I remained motionless, stunned by a terror that was like everything else, unique, uninterrupted, and absolute. I moved through the water of the black lake, perched on a piece of soil that looked like an earthen log. I had the feeling I was going in a southerly direction, transported by the current. I could see the water moving and swirling around. It felt cold and oddly heavy to the touch. I fancied it alive. There were no distinguishable shores or landmarks, and I can't recall the thoughts or the feelings that must have come to me during this trip. After what seemed like hours of drifting, my raft made a right-angle turn to the left, the east. It continued to slide on the water for a very short distance and unexpectedly rammed against something. The impact threw me forward. I closed my eyes and felt a sharp pain as my knees and my outstretched arms hit the ground. After a moment, I looked up. I was lying on the dirt. It was as though my earthen log had merged with the land. I sat up and turned around. The water was receding. It moved backward like a wave in reverse until it disappeared. I sat there for a long time, trying to collect my thoughts and resolve all that had happened into a coherent unit. My entire body ached. My throat felt like an open sore. I had bitten my lips when I landed. I stood up. The wind made me realize I was cold. My clothes were wet. My hands and jaws and knees shook so violently that I had to lie down again. Drops of perspiration slid into my eyes and burned them until I yelled with pain. After a while, I regained a measure of stability and stood up. In the dark twilight, the scene was very clear. I took a couple of steps. A distinct sound of many human voices came to me. They seemed to be talking loudly. I followed the sound. I walked for about 50 yards and came to a sudden stop. I had reached a dead end. The place where I stood was a corral formed by enormous boulders. I could distinguish another row, and then another, and another, until they merged into the sheer mountain. From among them came the most exquisite music. It was a fluid, uninterrupted, eerie flow of sounds. At the foot of one boulder, I saw a man sitting on the ground, his face turned almost in profile. I approached him until I was perhaps 10 feet away. Then he turned his head and looked at me. I stopped. His eyes were the water I had just seen. They had the same enormous volume, the sparkling of gold and black. His head was pointed like a strawberry. His skin was green, dotted with innumerable warts. Except for the pointed shape, his head was exactly like the surface of the peyote plant. I stood in front of him staring. I couldn't take my eyes away from him. I felt he was deliberately pressing on my chest with the weight of his eyes. I was choking. I lost my balance and fell to the ground. His eyes turned away. I heard him talking to me. At first, his voice was like the soft rustle of a light breeze. Then I heard it as music, as a melody of voices, and I knew it was saying, "What do you want?" I knelt before him and talked about my life, and then wept. He looked at me again. I felt his eyes pulling me away, and I thought that moment would be the moment of my death. He signaled me to come closer. I vacillated for an instant before I took a step forward. As I came closer, he turned his eyes away from me and showed me the back of his hand. The melody said, "Look." There was a round hole in the middle of his hand. "Look," the melody said again. I looked into the hole, and I saw myself. I was very old and feeble, and was running, stooped over, with bright sparks flying all around me. Then 3 of the sparks hit me, 2 in the head and 1 in the left shoulder. My figure in the hole stood up for a moment until it was fully vertical, and then disappeared together with the hole. Mescalito turned his eyes to me again. They were so close to me that I heard them rumble softly with that peculiar sound I had heard many times that night. They became peaceful by degrees until they were like a quiet pond rippled by gold and black flashes. He turned his eyes away once more and hopped like a cricket for perhaps 50 yards. He hopped again and again and was gone.